Hi, it's Karen Webster for Payments.com, and I'm here today with Sarah Davies, who is Senior Vice President, Analytics, Product Management, and Research for VantageScore. Sarah, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So the last time we talked, we spent a lot of time looking at and talking through scoring models, which is, of course, the business of VantageScore. And today I want to take the conversation into a little bit more depth around the three things that I think are very relevant to making a good lending decision. Obviously, it's having the right information, so the lender has access to the right information. They have a risk model that they are comfortable with. And then perhaps the third thing, which may be more relevant today, now that we have the benefit of 2020 hindsight, is the time frame in which information that they're basing their lending decisions on is obtained. What are your insights and observations with respect to those three variables as it relates to lenders making good credit decisions today?
Yeah, it's a very interesting time. Now that we are far away from the recession, we will actually learn about the interaction between those three variables, Karen. Why don't we start with sort of this idea of the relevant time frame? If you were to do nothing in terms of changing your strategy, and to do nothing in terms of the model that you were using and the information that you were kind of using within the model, I think having a sensitivity to the time frame could have resolved and could resolve a tremendous amount of exposure in your credit management strategies. So what I mean by that is, you know, there has historically been this perspective that a credit score has a fixed relationship to risk. And in reality, it doesn't. A 620 credit score, let's say in 2005, was associated with a default rate of roughly 3%. So if you as a lender had a strategy in place with a 620 score cutoff, then you were basically saying your P&L could handle a 3% default rate. Well, fast forward into the middle of the recession, and for all the reasons that we're well aware of, that 620 actually now equates to about a 6% default rate. Wow. If you as a lender had not updated your score cutoff, and you were still using that 620, you are now bringing in twice as much risk, twice as much loss into your business. Your P&L was really getting dragged down significantly. So when I talk about sort of the relevance of time frame, one of the critical learnings I think lenders have to have in their strategies is that they're kind of they've got their scores and their business set around the most current information they possibly could have. So that 620 should have been really set at maybe a 720 or a 750 in the middle of the recession in order to maintain that 3% default rate. And that's what's something that I think lenders didn't actually connect with heading into the recession. And here we are on the other side of the recession. And if they have now updated their score cutoff, so finally they set them at that 720, 750 level, what they'd find now is that actually the risk associated with a 720 is much, much lower. Perhaps it's actually a 2% default rate. So now what they're doing is they're actually cutting out a lot of consumers and they're missing a lot of opportunities. So keeping in sync with sort of the risk to score relationship is pretty critical. And that's really a function of just sort of being on top of where the industry is, where the economy is, and where lenders are, you know, where consumers are defaulting and not. So that's, I think, very critical.
Seems like such an obvious thing. Is it just hard for lenders to make these kinds of adjustments? Is the information not available to them in a timely fashion, or are they just too risk averse to want to make the change?
Well, it's a good question. It's a little of both, I think. You know, as we're heading into that recession, clearly you as a lender wouldn't want to be moving too many parts, so to speak. You know, the more moving parts, the harder it is to isolate what's exactly going on in terms of trying to control your environment. So certainly there was concern around that. I think the other thing was there certainly was a misunderstanding perspective that a 620 always had the same risk levels, and that was a misunderstanding. So it was a combination of effects. The way in which lenders can build their strategies can be extremely complex, and to unravel the strategy and rebuild it under a new score cutoff can take an awful lot of resources. And in an environment where everybody was very much pressed and constrained, perhaps those resources weren't available.
Is it the fact, too, that a 620 may not be a 620 depending upon the other variables and attributes of that particular borrower who is seeking credit? I mean, I guess the point is, are all 620s created equally? And is there an opportunity with looking at different information to make judgments about what 620 is good and what 620 might not be so good?
Absolutely, there is. One of the studies that we recently conducted was we actually looked at how it, let's call it, a score of 620 plays out in a particular mortgage strategy. And part of that strategy required that a consumer have a FICC file. A FICC file is a sort of industry language for basically saying the consumer needs to have a lot of trades, a lot of accounts on their credit file. And the idea here was that we as lenders were establishing a qualitative message and statement that said more information is better, and that information has to be lots of accounts. So lots of activity on lots of accounts, and a 620 on a FICC file was the criteria for being eligible for credit. And so we looked at the strategy, and what we found was that even though that, let's call it, strategy seemed very reasonable, in reality what it was doing was when you were pulling a credit score from only one credit bureau, even when it was a 620 and the consumer had a FICC file, those consumers were higher risk than if you pulled two credit scores on a consumer who weren't FICC file from multiple credit bureaus. So here what we're doing is shifting the strategy a little bit, saying it's not necessarily about getting a 620 on a FICC file. It's about getting about a 620 out of two credit bureaus, two different sources of information. And that actually delivers consumers who are lower risk than the incumbent strategy. I think that's one of the things we have to sort of be aware of also, is that when we say to ourselves we need more information, it's not necessarily more of the same information. And if we've learned anything, we need to be more diverse in the information we're bringing into our underwriting strategies. It's about getting different sources that are, let's say, independent of each other to allow a better corroboration of information in terms of risk.
It sounds like because of the deficits in getting the right kind of information at the right time, that lenders are leaving a lot on the table. Have you been able to quantify just how much of the addressable universe of borrowers most lenders are actually able to serve?
Yes. We took a look at a couple of different, let's say, ways of slicing and dicing the credit bureau databases. And our general estimate is that there are, let's say, approximately 220 to 230 million consumers with a credit file in at least one of the credit bureau databases. To get a credit score, a Vantage score or a ScoreX Plus or a FICO score, you need to have a credit file at the credit bureau. So 220 to 230 million consumers there. Now, a number of credit scores, I'm going to name them, let's call them conventional credit scores. These are sort of the more traditional scores. They require a certain amount of information in order to get a score. You have to have a trade that's 6 months older. You have to have that credit file updated within the last 6 months. If you don't have that updating or you don't have an old enough trade, you are unscorable. And from a lender's perspective, you are essentially invisible to that lender if the lender is using automated underwriting approaches. Well, when we look at the databases, we find that roughly 180 to 885 million consumers meet those conventional model requirements. But what that means is that 35 million or so consumers are unscorable. So from a lender's perspective, if you're using a particular scoring model, you've immediately lost 30 to 35 million consumers.
Wow.
Now, if you want to take it, let's go back to that strategy that we talked about, people with FICC files, so people who have three trades or more. And if we looked at that condition and said, you know, a lender, consumer not only has to have a FICC credit file, but they have to have a score of 620 or more, then what we find is that you actually cut out another 19 million consumers from your strategy. So, I mean, you've taken a large percentage of eligible consumers out of the mix simply because you're using, you know, a, let's say, a more conventional credit scoring model, but also because your strategy is designed to focus on qualitative criteria like FICC files in addition to a particular score cutoff. And you've cut out 50-some million consumers. who could be very eligible and perfect candidates for your types of strategies.
Yeah, I mean, that's more than 20% of the addressable market. I mean, that's a pretty sizable swath of consumers who would certainly sound like they'd be reasonable credit risks and would probably love to borrow. So given all of this, the opportunity that is going unaddressed and the complexity, it sounds like, of gathering the right information and, more importantly, providing that at relevant points in time so that these lending models can be adjusted for what's going on in the external environment. What do you advise the lenders to do? What is the right approach? What is the right strategy?
First and foremost, the best and easiest way to address the time frame issue, the lag in information, the lag in updating your strategies, is the best way to do it is certainly to get the latest performance charts from your score developer, whatever score you're using. All of these developers will produce what we call performance charts. And that is the most up-to-date statement of the risk level associated with a particular score. So if you had been getting your performance charts from us or any other developer, each year you would have seen that value of risk associated with 620 increase. And now over the last 2 or 3 years, you would have seen it deteriorate. And so once you have that information, you can make the appropriate adjustment in your strategy. That, I believe, would have actually solved a tremendous amount of exposure that occurred through the recession. So that's number one, relatively easy to do. And quite frankly, if you're using credit scores, you should always be doing that step. It's sort of the care and feeding of a credit score in your strategy. After that, though, getting into some of these other populations, you really do want to think about which credit bureau you're working with. The more bureaus you work with, the more information you're going to pull. And you also need to think about which credit scoring model you use. You want to make sure that model has been designed to give you the capability of looking at these other populations that not necessarily tied to having a lot of information in their file. So this is a good time really right now. You know, as I say, we're ready to start opening up the credit universe. This is a good time to test other credit scoring models if you're using more conventional models. This is a good time to start testing the value of other credit bureau data as you look to find safe ways to bring more consumers into your business.
So when you talk about asking for the latest performance charts, it seems like such a logical thing to do. Are they all updated on an annual basis? Are performance charts updated with a different frequency?
My understanding, and certainly I've been in the industry on and off around here for about 20 years, is all the major score providers, score developers, provide annual charts. So on an annual basis, these charts are updated. Major lenders will actually then build on top of those charts in terms of building some customization.
Right.
But you can do that within your own business. But these charts are available publicly and on an annual basis.
And is it that most lenders don't think that there's much change year to year, or...?
Certainly, I do think that was the case, yes, that we were, again, if you go back to that perspective that a 620 is always going to equal 3% default rate,
right,
then you don't think you should look at the latest odds charts coming out. I will say in the last 4 or 5 years, as we have spent a lot of time talking about this issue and place of exposure, you know, we now get a lot of requests to provide this information. So I think the industry has moved away from that mistaken understanding.
So you mentioned that having access and now being able to look at other scoring models and looking at how that might affect the ability for lenders to expand the universe of borrowers. Do you have any specifics with respect to how those that are using the VantageScore model have fared with this ability to capture the 20 or 25% of the addressable market that has been unavailable to others?
I don't have any specific results. Often lenders are, let's say, not excited about sharing it with me because I might share it with somebody else and give their competitor an edge or an opportunity to catch up with them. I will say that a number of lenders at this point in time are looking at and evaluating and using VantageScore 3 in a universe expansion strategy. So very intentionally stepping into new consumer populations using VantageScore such that they are able to accurately assess the risk and determine whether these consumers are providing the right kind of profit dynamic for their business. So there's a tremendous interest and a lot of testing going on right now into this space using VantageScore.
It's a fascinating topic. I really enjoyed our first conversation about the importance of thinking differently about models and how to look at data differently, and you've been able to really put it into a context with not only having access to the right information, but the importance of looking at it in a timely fashion and revisiting it often, which I think is a really wise insight. So thanks, Sarah. Thanks for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.